I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Motorsport Magazine podcast. I'm Samarth Canal, staff writer, and today we've got Karen Chandhok.
Hello, how are you doing?
We've got features editor Simon Aaron.
Hi there.
And we've got production editor Rob Ladbrook joining us.
Hello, everyone.
Excellent. Karen Chandhok's come all the way down from snowy English countryside to join us. We're very grateful for that, and we have a ton to talk about. Just firstly, I wanted to mention that he's going to join us for our F1 season preview evening in March, and that's sponsored by Footman James and Classic and Sports Finance. So I'm sure we'll touch on that later. But Karen, firstly, thank you for joining us. And what have you got planned this year in terms of Williams heritage, any sports car racing? Are you jumping back into the seat?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to come down here. And you've made me an extremely powerful coffee, so I'm going to be bouncing off the walls for the rest of the afternoon. But
you're expecting HRT coffee. It's given you Williams Renault, hasn't he?
Basically, yeah. It's a full V10 in that one, yeah. No, it's always nice to come down and have a chat. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be traveling to most of the Grand Prix with Sky, for the Formula One coverage, so that takes a big chunk of the year. With Williams, we're in the process of building up two very special cars, which I can't tell you about at the moment, but one in particular is going to be more powerful than that coffee, and I'm very, very excited about. So all will be revealed in a little while. But also we've got some other projects. We've got some interesting other activities planned around heritage, all of which will start to roll out sort of from March onwards publicly. And, you know, the business is growing. We've got new clients, and that just means more cars for me to test and shake down and to help grow that business. So that's good fun. Still managing a couple of young Indian drivers. Arjun Maini's going to be doing a bit of sports cars this year. Kush is, racing in the Formula Renault Euro Cup, or whatever it's called nowadays, Formula Renault. Something new Formula Renault, let's call it. I just call it Euro Cup anyway. So yeah, they're doing okay. And bits and pieces of other stuff. Fifth gear, late in the summer. And so back for another season of that, hopefully. Enough to keep me out of trouble.
How do you describe yourself nowadays? Are you Karun Chandhok racing driver? Or are you Karun Chandhok motor racing pundit?
I wear many hats, I suppose. I think the reason I do all the other stuff is because I'm a racing driver to start with. I think that's the foundation to my career, really, is, and that has sort of given me the experience and the credibility to do all of these other things. So yeah, I think fundamentally that's still the basis. But over and above the driving, I now, I've got a media career that's building in print and podcasts and obviously television is the main thing, but also consultancy stuff. I'm working. I did a lot of work with when Bernie had the Indian Grand Prix. My dad and I ran the Grand Prix for him for that time. Work with different manufacturers. I ran the GT Academy program for Nissan and PlayStation in India at the time. Some other driver talent hunts, including the truck racing hunt for Tata. So there's lots of other consultancy stuff. And also I'm doing lots with the FIA now. I'm a member of the Drivers Commission since the start back in 2013. And off the back of that, I go to the single-seater commission meetings. I was, part of the driver grading committee to do the much hated driver grading system for sports cars at GT racing, which gave me a lot of headaches. But, so I enjoy having a dabble in all sorts of, areas of the sport.
What I want to know is, because all you've been tweeting about recently is how quickly you can change a nappy. How the hell do you find time to change nappies when you seem to have 58 different jobs?
It tends to happen. It tends to happen at 4 a.m. I'm down to a minute 46, but I'm struggling to get quicker than that at the moment because he's being less cooperative. But no, it is great fun. It's less than 2 months now, but it's been an adventure.
So no cadet kart just yet.
Oh God, no, no! I've actually restarted playing tennis, which I stopped playing for about 30 years because I figure a tennis racket and balls is infinitely cheaper than a go kart. And if he wants to go play golf, then well, I'll have to find some other. Maybe Peter Dumbreck or somebody could go teach him play golf. But I'll try everything possible to keep him away from motor racing.
He's got a motor racing mad grandfather as well, hasn't he?
And great-grandfather, and great-grandmother, my great, you know, my
there
grandma.
There is really no hope, is there?
No, I know. My grandma used to race as well. So, yeah, we'll see. My brother escaped. He managed to avoid motor racing in general until I started racing GP2 in places like Monaco and stuff, and then suddenly got interested again, funnily enough. But, yeah, we'll see.
Just talking of obviously extreme youngsters in this case, but just thinking about motor racing in general, when I was growing up in the 1970s, it always used to perplex me that Britain, which is a little small island, had, you know, lots of Grand Prix drivers, but vast countries, India, China, Russia, you know, weren't represented at all. And then as you get a bit older and you find out a bit more, you discover there's no motor racing infrastructure. I mean, just what was the infrastructure like in India when you started racing? How easy? I know your dad was a rally champion and there was a family involvement, but I mean, how easy was it for you to get involved at your stage, and have things changed in the last sort of 17, 18 years?
I think I was very lucky for the reason you mentioned. You know, I grew up in a motorsport family. My grandfather used to race, and he started the ASN in India, the federation, which is now obviously part of the FIA. My dad raced from 1972 onwards and did some rallying. You know, he had an ex Elio De Angelis Chevron Formula 2 car that he used to race again, and they sort of had an all-in-one category. So he'd be in this F2 car against Vijay Mallya, in an Ensign F1 car against someone in an Atlantic, you know, Formula 4, and they'd all sort of go around the country racing on runways, disused, you know, World War II runways. But it was a very, I don't like to use the word amateur, but in the way, you know, if you compare it to the professional categories of racing that you had in Europe at the time, it was far behind that. But, you know, they had huge crowds. I still remember going to watch my dad race, a place called Sholavaram outside Madras. They used to get 65, 70,000 people there to watch these guys race on a T-shaped circuit with a couple of chicanes. And they'd be, you know, they'd be betting going on in the car park, and it was absolutely bonkers. You know, cover page on all the newspapers and magazines, and it was incredible stuff at the time. But, you know, when you talk about infrastructure towards building a Formula One driver, it was way behind. I think by the time we got to my level of racing, you know, we still had only one racetrack, which was in Madras, on the outskirts of Madras, which again my granddad and a couple of his buddies designed on a paper napkin sitting in a bar and then called someone from FISA in Paris to come down and certify it, and that's basically the circuit that was built. But I was lucky, it was an hour from my house, so I could, you know, I learned how to drive there. When I was 9 years old, I learned how to drive a road car there, and I spent all of my free weekends going up with my dad. And by that stage, he was driving less and less and starting to run teams more. We ran a Formula 3 team. We had people like Steve Robertson and Warren Hughes and Hilton Cowie and all these sort of people come and drive for us. So I grew up in that environment, you know, watching racing. You know, I following motorsport was very difficult at the time. I still remember the first live F1 race was a 1993 Spanish Grand Prix, which is amazing to think about, because I've been watching races since 87, and it was because we had a friend of ours, Martin Stone, who was a partner at Carlin Motorsport, and not used to be at least. He used to record these VHS tapes, so I would watch the British Grand Prix in like October or something. And we get copies of, magazines that would arrive 6-8 weeks after the race. So I read about the Phoenix race in the summer, so things like that. But, the interest in the sport just grew from a very young age. And that's where I started.
Because I remember, I think the first time we met, was probably at Spa in 2007 when you scored a GP2 with Durango. It was one of the Bridgestone lunches, and you was telling me that whenever there was a gap in the sporting schedules on Indian TV, instead of doing anything like show a motor race, it was always a replay of a India versus Australia test in 1979-80 or something. But that just absolutely dominated to the exclusion of almost all other international sport.
Yeah, completely. I mean, you know, to give you an example, when Bernie wanted to put Formula One on terrestrial TV in 2002-03, something like that, and he called my dad up and said, I wanted to get this done, want it on terrestrial TV, I'll give you the rights for free. And we went, wow, this is mega. This is it. This is my racing budget sorted here. We're going to be able to sell these rights for a fortune. And what we didn't realize is Bernie had already done the research and worked out he couldn't get it on terrestrial TV for free. And we had to pay a fortune to the broadcaster to put it on, effectively buying advertising time. So after 3 years and a lot of work of trying to sell advertising, I think we made about $5,000 on it or something, which so it didn't pay for anything racing wise. But it took a long time. And I mean, I never did a go-kart race in my life. And I think, and really, when I got to F1 in 2010, I bought a Rotax kart and I would be out there twice a week in it. And only then did I realize how much I missed. You know, there's so much that a Lewis or a Nico Rosberg or whatever, these guys who have been karting since they were in their nappies, you know, they learn so much about the feel of a new tire and how to extract that extra bit of grip and how to drive in different conditions and the wheel-to-wheel racing as well. I think, you know, certainly people like Naren and myself who came from India, I think we missed a huge part of that in our careers.
Is the infrastructure there now, though, in India, that, you know, emulating Germany, the UK, even Finland, is there a karting infrastructure there? Are kids being brought up to learn the tricks of the trade early on?
I don't think it's fair to compare India to a European country. I think in terms of motorsport infrastructure, I think you need to compare us with Malaysia and Indonesia and countries in that part of the world. It has gotten better. You know, we do have now multiple single-seater championships. We do have, two-stroke karting in both cadets, juniors, and seniors, all three categories. So, you know, there is now a basis where kids are able to compete. India is a very big country, and geographically it's really difficult because, you know, you've got three proper kart tracks which can run proper, you know, Rotax or, you know, IMEI or whatever. And, you know, for a kid, let's say in Delhi, who wants to be a racing driver, they can't just drive there. You know, it's not like you live in London, you drive out to Shennington or Wilton Mill and do your event after school and get back and you're back at school on Monday. You know, in India, you've got to fly. An 8 or 10 or 12-year-old isn't going to fly on their own, so a parent has got to go along. There's a cost to all of that. And so it is much harder still. And, you know, whether that improves, it's not really growing at a rate high enough, I think. And I think that comes back to Simon's point of sitting here today, why we've only still had two people out of 1.2 billion race in Formula One and only one race at Le Mans. And, you know, it's a very small minority.
I mean, when you were competing in Formula Maruti, your first single-seater in 2000, was that, at the time, was that just a bit of fun for you? Or were you actually harbouring dreams of being able to compete internationally?
It's really funny, actually, and it's only when I got to my mid-20s I realised that I was unique, because ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be a racing driver, and I became a racing driver. And it's only when I sort of got to my mid-20s and I started meeting friends of mine who, you know, finished school, went to their undergrad degrees, worked for a year or two, still hadn't quite found what was their calling in life and what was their sort of ideal career. Only then I realized that actually I was quite unique. Ever since I was, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, as far as I can remember, I wanted to be a racing driver. I didn't want to do anything else. So, yeah, I mean, it was interesting because when I was 15, I was a fat little kid. You know, I'd hit 96 kilos, so I wasn't small. And basically, I turned 16 in January 2000. And that was the time when you could get a race license only at 16. Now it's now become 15, of course. So I went to my dad. I went, well, I'm 16 now. I'd like to be a racing driver. And he just looked at me and said, no chance. And we made a deal that if I lost 25 kilos, then, you know, we would talk about it again. And I went on a massive, you know, lifestyle change. I stopped eating all the crap that I used to and started exercising. And I lost 26 kilos in 10 months.
Can I ask you for a few tips afterwards?
It's just maths. Honestly, it's purely mathematics, because I'm very much a numbers person. Lee McKenzie will tell you all about it. I'm constantly sitting with a spreadsheet in front of me working out all sorts of things. But, you know, I just did the math. I was like, this is the number of calories I consume. This is the amount I burn. And if one outweighs the other, then I lose weight. If it's the other way, you gain weight. It's just math. And that was it. So my dad could then see that I was committed to it, and, you know, I was putting in the hard work. So, and all that happened in that year, 2000. I started racing. I was still in my final year of high school, doing my A-levels at the time. And in India, you have to do a mandatory of 4 A-levels. And I ended up doing 5. But it's, so it was a busy year, trying to lose weight, trying to be a racing driver, and 5 A-levels.
I must say, I've heard of very few Indian parents asking their kids to lose weight. Whenever I go home and see my family, I'm always too thin. So that, you're very lucky to have health conscious parents.
But I mean, that's like losing 2/3 of Anthony Davidson in the space of 10 months. I mean, how is that possible?
Yeah. Yes, basically. but no, it was, and that's where I kicked off. And, you know, for me, racing in India was, I did 1 year, obviously I won the Indian Championship. And at the time, there was a sponsor called JK Tire who paid for a scholarship for me to race in Asia, in Formula Asia in 2001. And then they carried on backing me all the way until Formula One.
I mean, when you first came to Europe and did your first European race, was it much of a culture shock from what you were used to, or was the level comparable to what you started out in?
Well, first of all, I landed in the UK on the 1st of February 2002. And we'd been here on family holidays, and I'd been here to watch racing. You know, I'd been to watch Narain race in Formula 3, and, you know, shared a hotel room in a travel lodge at Junction 10 of the M40 and things like that when he was racing at Silverstone. And, you know, so obviously I'd been here. But coming on the 1st of February, when it was getting dark at 3 in the afternoon, you're just, what is going on? And the team, I'd come in November the previous year to do a test with Carlin, and it was down at Pembrey. And I'd never heard of Pembrey, never been before. And Trevor sent me an email with the directions. And it was just a one-line email. And I thought, oh, it can't be that far. And it basically said, M4, Junction 48, follow the signs. It was only when I left Heathrow and got on the M4 and realized, oh, wait, hang on a second, this is Junction 2 or something. So it was a huge culture shock. I'd never driven with cold tires. I'd never driven in the wet. I'd never, you know, had the level of competition that you have in. And that, you know, that was still a time where British F3 was proper British F3. You know, when I think back, 2004, the season we did there, the drivers that were in it, you know, you look at where they've all gone on now. You had Degrassi, Piquet, Adam Carroll, you know, Ernesto Viso, Will Power, Will Davison. You know, there's so many good drivers, lots of whose names escape me at the moment. You know, the level was so strong at the time, and I learned a hell of a lot. You know, that those 2.5 years I did with T-Sport before I ran out of money was really good. And just traveling to all the British circuits, you know, when you're at, and also I think coming from a country like India, you know, you could have carried on living a life out there and enjoying the 30 degree sunshine all year round. And suddenly, you know, I'm on my own in a town. You know, I lived in Brackley. I didn't know anybody there. I'd gone from a city of 11 million people to a town of 11,000 people, middle of nowhere, really. And all of a sudden, you know, you're on your own and you're 18 years old. But I think that's where the motivation comes in. And I think that's why a lot of the non-European drivers, you know, you get mentally very, very strong, because you come here and you've got to get off your bum and you've got to go training. It's totally counterintuitive to what you're used to be out there running in the cold, wet weather in March. But you know, if you're not doing it, then somebody else is. And I think mentally, you know, in that 2.5 years, I probably aged 15 years. You know, I grew up, really.
I mean, it must have been almost like you came in to that year because a lot of the guys will have been known beforehand before they turned up, and then you come in as, like you say, fresh to Europe, and being from a country that wasn't then known for kind of motorsporting history. I mean, did you find it a struggle at all? Did you feel a bit more pressure to prove yourself? Or
there was a lot more pressure from home, you know, because at the time, Naren hadn't yet competed in F1, so India hadn't yet produced a Formula One driver. That came in 2005. So there was a lot of pressure on both of us, and there wasn't, you know, a huge amount of knowledge, I would say. You know, I would go off and I remember going to do PR events in some city that a go-kart track, there was one which stands out. And I remember the journalists, and this was from the Times of India, which is, you know, the highest circulated newspaper in the country. And the journalist said to me, he says, oh, what's the difference between this and a Formula One car? And, you know, he's standing at a rental go-kart track. And, you know, I'm generalizing here. There were obviously a lot of journalists who had more knowledge. But from a broad perspective, the knowledge level still wasn't there. But all they knew was India hasn't yet had a Formula One driver. And the expectations were that, you know, there's a lot of pressure on one of these two guys to do it. And so, and also from a financial standpoint, you know, my family begged, borrowed, stole, remortgaged everything that they could. They didn't steal. I should just clarify that.
I was going to ask you what they'd stolen. Yeah.
No, they didn't do that. But, you know, there was, you know, my mum was selling paintings and all sorts of things just so I could have an extra set of tires so I could go testing. And then, you know, we got to 2005, I remember, and you look at it and halfway through the year, Nelson Piquet Jr. had done twice the number of test days and he'd had twice the number of sets of tires, and you just go, I just can't compete with that. You know, you just can't. And at that stage, we just completely run out of money, and the bank manager's on the phone and all sorts in a very Nigel Mansell-esque way. But it wasn't easy. And you know, we had sponsors and we had certain backers, but it didn't cover the budget. And I think that's where the pressure was really high. Was, you know, you were every set of tires, you know. And now in hindsight, when I look back at that phase, actually getting out of the pressure cooker of Europe after the 2.5 years, and going to Asia to race in 2006, where again the level was lower, but it just allowed me to take a breather. You know, get my energy back, start to enjoy my racing again, because I think between 2003-4-5, you know, the pressure was immense, and you know, the debt was off the chart, and that just added a huge family pressure.
So how did you recover from the financial meltdown to being able to buy your way into GP2 in 2007?
It was interesting because you know, at the end of 2005, I'd done a bit of A1 GP. I'd done a bit of World Series by Renault, you know, and just completely, that was it. No money at the end. And then Renault started up this championship in Asia with a Renault V6 cars. And the promoter, David Sonnenscher, got in touch with me and said, look, you know, we're starting up this championship. What do you want to come and do it? And I managed to get some sponsorship from a couple of companies in, you know, one in India, one in Asia, and they covered the budget. And so I went off and did that for a year. And actually Renault put up a bit of prize money as well, which was quite handy. But in September that year, I came to see Bernie. And I said to him, I said, look, I'm racing in Asia, but obviously that's not going to get me to F1. I need to be back in Europe. Do you have any ideas? And he went, tell you what, when you win that championship, give me a call. And I waited till November, won the championship. So I called him up and said, oh, yeah, won the championship now. What do you think? And he went, oh, yep, leave it with me. And then didn't hear anything. So we've gone through all through Christmas and, you know, call him a couple of times. I'm working on it. Nothing. And then we went all through, you know, probably the first half of January, and I'm going, yeah, this is not happening now. You could see the GP2 grid. I'm online. I'm seeing the grid filling up, thinking this is just not happening. He had organized a test with Campos for me before. That's the one thing he did do, but then nothing came off the back of it. And I had then spoken to my friend Anthony Hyatt, who runs Double R Racing, and said, look, you know, I'm out of money, not going to go racing, but I still want to be involved in the sport. Have you got any jobs for me? And he said, well, actually, I could probably do the TM for this team. I'm looking for somebody to help run the team for me. So, yeah, we could sort something out. So I was all ready to come back to the UK to be a, you know, to be an employee for his Formula 3 team. And at the end of January, Bernie called and said, right, I think there's a deal on the table. I think Red Bull are interested in doing something with you. So here's Danny Baha's number. Give him a call. And then, at the time, so I didn't do the deal with Helmut. I didn't speak to Helmut at all. I spoke to Danny Baha, who was there. And he put me on the Red Bull program. They were looking to expand the program. They wanted to have some other drivers from other parts of the world outside Europe. And the timing worked. And, that literally spoke to Danny, spoke to Bernie. 3 days later, I was on the plane to do a seat. I was the last driver signed on the grid for 2007. 3 days later, I went to Italy to seat fit for Durango and off to Rickard for the test.
But it wasn't a full Red Bull deal. Was it just a patches and overalls kind of thing?
No, but they paid a good chunk of the budget. So that basically, Bernie negotiated the deal with Durango. So I didn't actually know what the budget was. I had some Indian sponsors. He said to me, he said, right, how much sponsorship have you got? I had that. And obviously he knew how much, or I told him how much, Danny was willing to put in from Red Bull. And basically, he called Durango up and sorted the deal. So I never signed the contract. I'm very thankful to Bernie. He was very, very helpful to me at that phase. And, I'll always be grateful to him because that's saved my career.
Can you remember the feeling on that Sunday at Spa? Of all places to score your first GP2 win.
I can, actually, because, first of all, I remember being on the grid and Bernie and Flavio showed up on the grid together. And it was a bit, already I was sort of, you're there on the front row. And I'd had a couple of decent races earlier. I should have won in Istanbul and Kazuki Nakajima took me out with a handful of laps to go. And then I think he apologized profusely afterwards, but it didn't really help. and I think, we'd had a couple of other decent races. So I knew we were getting stronger as the year went on. And as far, already you're on the front row of the grid, you're feeling a bit of pressure, and then Bernie and Flav show up and Bernie says, you better win this. And I went, all right. He says, yeah, Dietrich's in my bus, we're going to watch the race together. And I went, oh God. fortunately it was a good race. I still remember clearly, coming up to La Source, and I thought, yeah, I've managed to get the tires. I've managed the tires a bit more than Andy Suchek. I remember thinking, if I just give myself enough of a gap on the run down from La Source to Eau Rouge, I can be flat through Eau Rouge in the slipstream and not lose too much downforce. Because at that time, with the old, that was a first generation GP2 car, on race tires, with race fuel, it wasn't comfortably flat in the slipstream. It was flat if you were in clean air. It wasn't comfortably flat. And I made sure I got a good toe through. And when I went up to Les Combes, I thought, right, I'm there on the outside. And I'm just going to break as late as I could. I still remember every frame of that part of the lap to get in for the lead. And there's only three or four laps to go. And one of the first people I saw after the race was our friend David Tremaine, who's obviously one of the best journalists and
I wouldn't say that.
Well, you can tell him it, but he's somebody that I whose opinion I greatly respected, and I remember him coming to me after the race saying, "Yeah, that was a proper move. Well done, chap." And he sort of stopped, and I thought, "Okay, yeah, thanks." But I was very, very good memories of that day.
I mean, you won at Hockenheim as well in GP2, but I mean, you had some. Monaco 2009, you were romping away with a sprint race. Now, did you break the car or did the car break itself? Remind me.
No, the drive shaft broke.
But had you hit something?
No, not a mark on the wheel rim, not a mark on the tyres, nothing. And that remains probably the biggest disappointment of my career. As you say, I'd gotten into the lead at the start, past Maldonado, who was a bit of a specialist around Monaco.
He was, yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know, he was quicker than any category.
He crushed at every other circuit, but Monaco, he was dynamite.
He was blindingly quick, yeah. God knows how. But, you know, I'd pulled 3 seconds on him, and we had pulled nearly 20 seconds over Jerome D'Ambrosio and Nico Hülkenberg and people like that who were in the train behind. And, you know, we were gone into the distance. And at that stage, you know, Pastor said to me, he says, at that point, I thought, I'm just going to settle for second. And equally, I was going, right, you know, this, I'm happy with the pace, no risks. And couldn't believe it. I came out of Anthony Noel's onto the start finish straight, and it lost drive. And over time, what transpired was that I was with a new team, Ocean Racing Technology, and it transpired that they had changed one of the drive shafts before the race in Monaco. But normally what you should do is change both. And that's what happened. The one they hadn't changed snapped. So, really gutted. I had a lot of tequila that night.
Well, because I did an interview with you the following day. We did for a travel company. We did a talk, and you seemed quite chipper. The tequila hangover didn't last.
I was probably still pissed, Simon.
Possibly.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Moving on from GP2 to Formula One. I mean, you never had a crack in a proper, with all due respect to Caterham and HRT.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, your year with HRT or half year with HRT in 2010, was that good for the character or terrible for the morale or both?
No, look, ultimately it was a culmination of a dream, you know, and that's something that, you know, being on the grid and arriving in the paddock as a Formula One driver, that'll, you know, whatever happens from that day forward, I could call myself a Formula One driver.
Yeah,
you'll always be a Formula One driver. And so that, to me, was a culmination of a dream. It was huge news out in India. I remember my brother called me up and said, you know, when the news got announced, I was alone in Murcia in Spain when they did the launch. My family were all back in India. My brother called me and said, you can't believe your dad's in floods of tears watching the news and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, it was great for us as a family. And then obviously it all imploded into a mess. And it was a real shame because I remember going to the seat fit at Dallara and I met Jeff Willis and my race engineer, Richard Connell, who's now at HPP. And we went along and had a look, you know, with the designers. Ben Nagathangalu was there, who's now obviously at Haas with Dallara. And, you know, it showed me all the drawings that they had. And they said, look, the car that's going to the launch in Murcia, the hotel, is just a launch car. Unfortunately, because we're late, that looks like that's what you're going to have for the first four races. But there were 60 points of downforce there. And, you know, Dallara build good cars. You see what they're doing with Haas. Obviously, yeah, they've got Ferrari support. But, you know, you look at the other categories, they do build good cars. And it was a real shame because they had a car there with 60 points of downforce, which would have put us into Toro Rosso territory. You know, you'd have been a very respectable, you know, front of the new teams, back end of the midfield teams. But for various reasons, obviously between Colin Collis and the Carabantes and Dallara, there was a fallout, which, you know, involves probably three different podcasts for me to go into. And the updates never came. And unfortunately, that, you know, as things went along, then you know, the money in Spain started to dry up and they needed financial backing, so that cost me. You know, they needed, you know, they got Saccon into the car, but yeah, it was it was a character building season, but you know, I've still got very good memories of it. You know, going to Bahrain for my first race, I remember Michael Schumacher was the first driver who came up and shook my hand as we were doing these FIA, the medical checks, and it was his first race back off, you know, yes, with Mercedes after his little break. And he came and shook my hand and he said, "Welcome to Formula One, good luck." And I thought, "Yeah, you're Michael Schumacher. You were one of my heroes when I was a kid." He didn't need to do it, but I thought it was really, really nice of him.
I reckon he was watching Formula Maruti races on television 10 years beforehand. That's what I reckon.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
But, I mean, one of the things that sticks in my mind about that particular weekend was arriving in the paddock on Wednesday or Thursday and, you know, watching all of the established teams just going through their usual pre-season prep. And then HRT, not so much Lotus Caterham, but also Marussia Virgin. I went into the Marussia Virgin garage and you know, everybody, including John Booth, the team principal, they're down on their hands and knees with fret saws and hacking bits of carbon. And they're still. And, I mean, your car, I think, was just about the last to be finished, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You didn't get out until Saturday or something.
Yeah, the first lap I did was qualifying.
Yeah.
You know, which wasn't really qualifying. It was a shakedown. It was an installation. We did an installation lap in qualifying, you know, with 60 kilos of fuel or something. But it's, yeah, that was a character building weekend, definitely. And I changed in and out of my overalls probably a dozen times because I kept saying, yep, the car's ready. Oh, wait, it's not. And it just kept going back and forth. But yeah, it was bizarre.
But it was, to me, a bit like a sort of old school 1970s sort of Formula One weekend with just everybody mucking, you know, bigger sized teams, obviously, but everybody mucking in. And it was just, there was a real kind of sense of spirit down that end of the pit lane with everyone fighting to get the cars ready.
Yeah, I mean, the mechanics, the hours they did, you know, they were doing 48-hour shifts. And you're sometimes worried. These guys, you know, I'd see them, the guy would be in the cockpit to bleed the brakes and he'd fall asleep, you know, in that time when they'd sort of, you know, need to open and close the caliper nipple. So, you know, they're just exhausted. God knows how they did it. And they'd had to do it again when we got to Australia. They're doing, you know, 40-50 hour shifts. It was just extraordinary. But it's a real shame, you know, on the whole, with the whole HRT team, because if you look at the people we had in the race engineering office, you know, they'd assemble a good team of people. You know, Jeff Willis is now at Mercedes. Tony Chicoria left and became a chief race engineer at Ferrari. As I said, Richard Connell is now at HPP. Yeah. Chevy Pujala is now chief engineer at Sauber. You had Stephen Mitas, who became chief race engineer on the LMP1 Porsche program. You know, you had a lot of good people involved in the race team, and you had Dallara there, who had the potential to build a good car. So, you know, there were a lot of good ingredients there. Unfortunately, just the money from Spain just wasn't there to get the project through. As it should have done.
We see Formula One grind down a lot of drivers if things aren't going their way and it's outside of their control. How do you keep your mentality? Because it must be quite hard that first season, because you must be there going, well, the car's not working, but I know I'm quicker than him. Why can't I get a chance to show it? How do you...
It is difficult. But ultimately, you know, your point of reference is your teammate and your point of reference is the other people in similar situations. You know, we had the odd race where I could beat Timo or Lucas. You know, I remember Montreal had a good race there, and Valencia was another good one where I was able to beat one of the Marussia cars, which was for us was our own little victory, really. You know, Monaco was a pretty good race as well till Jarno ended up on my head. You know, we had those odd races, and that sort of kept your motivation up. I think the following year, you know, when basically I'd done this deal with Tony Fernandez and Lotus, and you know, the politics in that team was just horrendous. You know, it's a shame because again they had some good people. You know, people like Dieter Gast, Jody Eggington. There's some really good people in there, but they had all the politics of a big team in a small team. And you know, in hindsight, I regret that experience, you know, and not doing the Indian GP and stuff. You know, I had a contract in place to do a certain number of races that year, and then that didn't happen. And then, you know, it took forever for Tony. I finally got compensated for it out of court with Tony because he knew, you know, I had a contract there, and we got it settled. But it really wasn't a fun year for me. you know, being a reserve driver there, I had a contract to do a whole bunch of Fridays and some testing, and it kept getting pulled from me, and the, you know, the days weren't going well, and I wasn't enjoying it, and I wasn't driving well either. And I just constantly felt like just a spare part that nobody really wanted, you know, and it wasn't an enjoyable experience, but I learned from it. And I think not getting the chance to do the Indian GP when I had a rock solid contract to do it, and we had a lot of other stuff lined up around it, that was a huge blow. And that was probably the only time in my life I've fallen out of love with Formula One. I didn't watch a race for 6 months. I didn't watch another race till the middle of 2012. I completely fell out of love with Formula One. Didn't want to read about it. Didn't want to know about it. I thought, that's it. I hated it at that time.
Well, that's just like going back to the early days when you're watching it 6 months late on VHS, surely.
Yeah.
It was just a wheel turning full circle.
Just to clear up for me, why did that chance get taken away from you then in terms of the inner politics of the team?
Tony and certain members of the team basically said they didn't want to change the driver lineup. They just wanted to keep Jarno in the car. The deal was that I would replace Jarno for four races. And it just didn't happen. So it is a shame. And, you know, again, that's another team that had some good elements to it and good people in it. And, you know, race engineers and people like that worked incredibly hard. And it's a shame that, you know, there's a lot of internal politics to it, and the financial backing they were hoping to get from the Lotus brand didn't materialize, and they never quite were able to make the next step up. So, you know, when you look at modern F1, you know, the last new startup before Haas to really make it was Stewart Grand Prix, really, when you think about. And they did it because they had a huge backing from Ford. And, you know, I think it's that makes what Haas have done all the more commendable, really. You know, they've come at it with this different business model and made it work, which is really impressive.
As I say, it's very true, because, I mean, BMW and Toyota both came with massive investments, stayed around for four or 5 years and won one race between them.
Yeah,
which is,
you know,
which that's... Is why A bit of luck as Lewis clattered Kimi in the pit lane of Canada.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I mentioned Stewart, and I purposely avoided Toyota because it's a very different model coming in as a billion-dollar manufacturer to a startup team.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think? I mean, the one Grand Prix you did do in 2011 in Germany. I mean, do you think basically your performance suffered that weekend because all of the background stuff that was going on?
No, I just didn't do a good job because, you know, until that point I hadn't driven the car on the dry. Every time I had a you know, FP1 session before that, immediately before the Silverstone it rained, Istanbul it had rained. I was meant to do the Jerez test, and then I didn't get to do the Jerez test. I was meant to do a Barcelona test, then I didn't do a Barcelona test. You know, I didn't get to do FP1 in Barcelona because they had some updates on the car. So basically, the first time I drove the slick Pirelli tire, I shunted the car in Melbourne, which was my own fault, of course. But the first time I drove the slick tire was an FP1 in the Nürburgring. And as we now know, the Pirelli is a very different tire to the Bridgestone. So I don't think I fully got my head around it. And, you know, I just got thrown in the deep end. Basically, I remember as Tony walked to the grid in Silverstone, he came to me and said, because I was meant to do races towards the end of the year. You know, we were talking about Japan, Korea, India, you know, sort of back end of the year. But he came to me as he was walking to the grid at Silverstone and said, I want to put you in the car for the Nürburgring next time out. How do you feel about it? And I went, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say no, of course. And, but, you know, in hindsight, it would have been nice to have done a bit of testing and actually have driven the car on the dry before that. But, yeah, so, you know, I don't think I did a particularly good job that weekend. Well, I know I didn't. But equally, I think there were plenty of circumstances that didn't help me either.
You're among friends now, you can tell us. Were there ever any opportunities to land a seat with a team slightly higher up the grid, or were the opportunities just not there?
No, I think, you know, there were a couple of opportunities which I turned down to be test drivers, reserve drivers, sim drivers, to take that Caterham drive in 2011. You know, I think in 2010, I'd done a respectable job, you know, alongside Bruno. And, you know, I think I'd sort of established myself as a respectable, credible driver. And there were, you know, there were opportunities to become sort of simulator and test and reserve drivers. But the draw of doing races, even if it was only going to be two or three or four races with Lotus, despite being at the back of the grid, you know, it was still going to be racing rather than simulator or testing. And I went with that. And I think, you know, in hindsight, that broke some of the momentum for me. And after that, you know, I went down the sports car route. And all of a sudden, I discovered this whole world of sports cars. And actually, Anthony Davidson was the first one who said to me in 2011, when I started to really hate F1, he, you know, I remember speaking to him, and he said, you know what, you should really think about sports cars because you love it much more than you think. And he was absolutely right. You know, it's I discovered a whole world of racing, which has been very enjoyable.
I was going to say, was it like a almost like a breath of fresh air going into that environment?
Yeah, I mean, I approached the first half of the year quite badly, I think. I arrived with my sort of single-seater, selfish F1 mentality. Fortunately, I had two good teammates in David Brabham and Peter Dumbrake, who have since, you know, carried on being very good friends of mine. And I think I really annoyed them to start with, but eventually they got me to understand the sports car world, because, you know, you're used to me and wanting things done your way and wanting the car set up your way and everything done for you. And also you're used to competing against them. But all of a sudden, you know, they were helping me and I was helping them. But, you know, when you come from a single-seater background, when your teammate's trying to help you, you don't normally believe what they're telling you. You think they're lying to you. So it took me a while to understand. Oh, actually, hang on a second. They're actually, you know, saying the truth here. But they were great. And I, you know, it was an absolute breath of fresh air. Yeah.
Because your first, talk about your first Le Mans, because that was actually a very successful weekend for you. But a lot of Formula One drivers, because you're so in the Grand Prix bubble, when they turn up to Le Mans, they kind of go, wow, this is massive. This is bigger than I thought it would be. I mean, did you have an appreciation of Le Sartre before you went?
I mean, I'd been watching Le Mans, and obviously I knew what Le Mans was, and I did have an appreciation of how, you know, I was a big fan of Derek Bell, still have a big fan of Derek Bell, you know, and the Group C era of cars were fantastic. But you're absolutely right. I don't think when you come from the single-seater ladder, you don't really appreciate how big Le Mans is till you go there. And for me, you know, being the first Indian to do Le Mans was really special. I remember, I'm not a particularly emotional person. The two or three times in my career where it's been really emotional for me. One was winning that GP2 race at Spa, because that was the culmination of 4 years of really difficult times coming to an end. The second was, you know, second I must say was at Le Mans, because when I left the pits during the race, I went, this is a bit of history here. Nobody can take this away from me. I'm the first person to do this. And I remember in the warm-up, actually, getting up to the, you know, Dunlop chicane, and you go down the hill, and to the right-hand side near the bridge there, there's a campsite with a load of Indian flags. And I thought, all of those people have come because of me. You know, there's no other Indian on this grid here. It's kind of cool that this whole bunch of tents, people have come from God knows where. I never had the time to go see them, but they all had the Indian flags on the top of their tents. And I was like, that's really cool. And, you know, we had 30 or so journalists had come over from India to cover the event. And it was a big story. But also at Le Mans, I don't know if you know this, but they play the national anthem of every single driver. And, you know, when they play the Indian national anthem before the start, it was a real sort of goosebumps moment for me. And I think I think the only other emotional time I've had in a race car is when I drove Mansell's 14B, because, you know, that was a car I grew up watching. So, yeah, driving that at Silverstone was pretty amazing. So
how did you get your head around Le Mans? Because one of the things I always used to do as a matter of routine was take a bicycle with me. And on the Friday, I'd always cycle a lap of the circuit. And the first part of the circuit, it's like a racetrack. And then you kind of turn right at the end of the Hunodier Strait. And then suddenly, you know, you're bloody hell, on the run down to Indianapolis. And it's, even on a bicycle, it feels bloody narrow. I mean, how did you kind of get your head around the whole nature of the place?
It's just an amazing circuit. It was a weird Le Mans that year, because it had rained a hell of a lot all the way through the week. And we were struggling with the balance of the car, and the conditions were really tricky, and we didn't really get a happy balance on it through the week. And only when we got to the race, the car started to, you know, as the track rubbered up, it started to come towards us. But it meant that the team ended up using either Peter or David, who knew the circuit and knew the car, to set it up more. So I think in the race week, I only did something like 10 or 12 timed laps before the race. I obviously did my, you know, laps of the test, but I hadn't actually done a lot of laps, I remember, before the race. It was only in the race that I sort of got into it and really started enjoying it. But, you know, it's right up there. It's got to be one of the top five circuits in the world for a driver to drive on. You know, it's an amazing, amazing circuit. And there's something in it for everybody. There's high speed, low speed, bank corners, places to overtake. You know, it's such a challenge. And then you got the track conditions that, you know, you got 30 degree swing in track temperature even and things like that. So, yeah, it's an amazing experience. But I remember I was in the night. I don't know how, but I've done Le Mans now 5 times. But every time I end up with a graveyard shift, and I don't know why that happens. And it's all with different race engineers as well. But they always end up putting me in for the. You know, it's like they've talked to each other. I don't get it. But it's sort of that 1 a.m., 2 a.m. till, you know, 5, 6 in the morning through the night, which means basically you've been awake since midnight until 6 in the morning. I've ended up with it every time. But that first year, I remember on the run down to Indianapolis, the straight you're talking about, and there was one lap where there was just this cloud of smoke, and I thought, ooh, somebody's blown up there. It must be a load of oil or something, an engine's gone. And I backed out of it. And as I went through the kink, the right hand of Indianapolis, I thought, I can smell burgers. And basically, it was a campsite that just lit this massive barbecue. Smoke had wafted across the track. But, yeah, that was very funny. And I thought, yeah, this can only happen at Le Mans.
Just going back very briefly to Formula One, specifically the Indian Grand Prix, was it just a financial problem that, I mean, it was announced to great fanfare 2011, 2012, 2013, then stop?
Yeah, it was a private event, you know, and a bit like your situation here in the UK, it's not a it wasn't a government-funded event. And ultimately, you look at the calendar, I think it's just Suzuka, which is obviously Honda, that's and the British Grand Prix, isn't it, that are privately funded. I don't think any of the others are. They're all government-funded races. And ultimately, you know, the JP Group did an amazing job investing into the facility. They spent a fortune, you know, on the race for 3 years. They probably spent, you know, over the, call it a five-year period between breaking ground on the track to running the races, probably spent $500 million. Which is a huge amount of money for a private company to spend with no government backing. At some stage, they got to go, well, hang on a second, the government's not willing to back us in this and be our partner. It doesn't make financial sense. And, you know, unfortunately, motorsport and F1 just didn't seem to resonate with what the government wanted to do.
I mean, was India the right market for that at the time as well?
I think India was a fantastic opportunity and a fantastic market for Formula One. 7 teams picked up one race sponsorship deals. That doesn't happen when you go to the French Grand Prix or the German Grand Prix or even the British Grand Prix. You know, there was lots of Indian companies who put a bit of money in. There were, if you look at the car manufacturers involved in F1 at the time or now, frankly, you know, for them, India is a huge growth market and still continues to be a great growth market. Whether it's a brand like Red Bull or, you know, sponsors, again, India is a great consumer market. So I think it was an important race and therefore one that F1 embraced. But also, and Simon, you'll back me up here. You know, when we went to races like Istanbul, I remember 2007 being on the grid. I was on pole for the Sunday race. And my dad and I were standing on the grid and we looked at the grandstand and there were 11 people in the grandstand on Sunday morning for the race. You know, in contrast, the first Indian Grand Prix had 110,000 people there. You know, people forget India has and had a huge F1 fan base. The days of the Schumacher versus Hakkinen era made F1 explode across the country. You know, there's a huge fan following. So India already had a fan base, unlike China or Baku or Istanbul or these other places. And so therefore, yeah, it's, I think India was a good fit for F1. It's just a shame that financially the government weren't willing to back it.
Did the race's brief existence help raise the profile of motor racing in general, or because of Häkkinen and Schumacher, etc.? Was it already at a reasonably high level?
No, it was very, very powerful. Especially the first year and the first couple of years, I should say, you know, there was a huge amount of interest. And unfortunately, that's died away as the race has gone away. You know, I think the absolute peak of interest in F1 or in motorsport in general was that era, 2010 to 2012, because, you know, you had Naren and myself who were driving in F1 around that time. Force India had just been taken over. You know, Vijay had just taken over Spyker and was starting to come good as well. And we had the Grand Prix. You know, you had, you know, sort of four pillars there to build an interest base in the sport. And unfortunately, since then, you know, we haven't had any other drivers come in. You know, Force India has now been taken over by the Canadian consortium. So, and the race is gone. So the interest levels have just dipped away, really.
Any chance of it coming back at any point, or do you think that's it?
Realistically, I don't think so. You know, unless somebody in the government, you know, we get a big progressive movement within the cabinet and the sports ministry to bring the sport back and to bring the race back. Unfortunately, you know, there were plenty of opportunities. The racetrack itself was on the highway to Agra, where the Taj Mahal is. You know, they could have done there's a lot of opportunity there to have done, you know, co-branded events, you know, for tourism and things like that. But they never quite got that all off the ground.
And as far as I remember, I don't think the Indian government and the circuit organizers got off on their greatest foot after the event. There was some kind of financial attacks.
No, I mean, essentially, it's a long story, but basically there was a taxation issue which had implications for all the teams and the drivers and sponsors and FOM. A lot of those cases are still pending and still ongoing. So, you know, yeah.
We're not going to see it returning then.
No, I don't think it's... unless the government have a change of heart and get behind the sport, I don't see it happening again. Unfortunately, it's a real shame.
You mentioned earlier you've got a management role with the Mayinis, Arjun and Kush. Are there any many other sort of Indian kids who've caught your eye coming up through karting or junior categories?
Well, obviously those two, you know, I think they're both talented kids.
You're their manager, you would say that.
Obviously. But I think also Jehan Daruvala, who's going to be racing FIA F3 this year, I think he's very good. Again, you know, I know him and his dad quite well, and I speak to them every couple of months and just offer a bit of friendly advice, because I think ultimately, you know, they're following a path that we've been along, coming from the country that you know, doesn't have still the motorsport infrastructure of the West, although they've benefited from the infrastructure of karting and things like that, which we didn't when Naren and I came along. So they've already had a head start on us of probably 7-8 years of driving, you know. But I think, you know, there are a handful of them around. You know, Jehan's going to be with Prema, which is a top team in FIF3, so he's got a great opportunity to have a good year and build on that. So yeah, let's see how it pans out.
And one thing I definitely have to ask you about, I mean, away from all this modernism, you became a bit of a YouTube star last year with your ridiculously loopy lap of Goodwood in a McLaren M1. Just talk us through that.
I was wondering where you were going with that there for a second. I was like, oh, is there some video I haven't seen? I love going to Goodwood. It's a proper old school circuit. I mean, but every year I do get there and think, what are we doing? You know, this is just mad. I speak to people like Dario Franchitti, who's a good friend of mine, and go, you know, he tells me the story of his Jaguar E-Type accident. And I just go, what am I doing? Why am I bothering with this? It's not something you have to do, but it's something we love doing. And it's such a fun event. The track is a proper old school circuit. And driving these old cars, I mean, we're lucky, aren't we, Simon? We've got such a great, rich history in the sport. And I think it's really important to embrace that history. I enjoy driving the old cars. You know, that's why I got involved with Williams Heritage, you know, not just from the driving standpoint, but from the business standpoint, because it's part of it is showing off these old cars and telling the story of these old cars. Driving the M1A McLaren was a hell of an experience. I don't think the steering wheel was straight even for 1 second. It was wheel spinning in every single possible gear. But great fun. I think, you know, the gearbox broke on the out lap of practice qualifying. So the first lap I drove the car in at Goodwood, I did about 15 laps at Donington just to drive it. But the first lap I did was in the first lap of the race. And we ended up with fastest lap at the end of it. So it wasn't too bad having started the back of the grid. But yeah, the car owner is very keen to go back this year. So hopefully Charles March will invite us back and we can have a bit of fun. But I'm going to do the members meeting for the first time, which I've never been to. I'm told it's normally freezing cold and snowing.
Last year it was, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, Steve Soper told me to carry my thermals and all sorts and go along. So
fireproof thermals.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. Now, Goodwood's great fun, and you get a real appreciation. And actually, I'm in the middle of reading the David Tremaine's Jim Clark book. And, you know, there's some amazing pictures. I don't know if you've seen it. There's some amazing pictures of the Can-Am cars racing at Goodwood back in period, as well as obviously the F1s, things like that. And to think that actually the circuit kind of looks the same even now.
Yeah, it's a pity. There's a lot of the photographs that were taken at Goodwood in the 50s and the 60s. They're magnificent, but you can't take them now because we're no longer allowed to stand on the inside with our cameras, which is where a lot of the, you know, the really epic shots of cars drifting would take. They won't let you do it. But, I mean, the reason I ask you about the McLaren is we had a chat, you and I had a chat at Silverstone last June, whenever it was, when you, Mark Webber, and Susie Wolf did the demo in the old cars. And I said to you, you know, what about racing something like this at Goodwood? And you said, nah, I'm not so sure about something like this. Maybe an Austin Westminster maximum 90 brake horsepower. And then three months later, look at YouTube and hey, hang on.
I know.
That's a McLaren M1.
I normally like doing the St. Mary's Trophy because the cars are not extraordinarily powerful, but they're great fun. And it's right, you know, in a Mini or something like that, or, you know, Austin A35 or something. They're not stupidly quick. But yeah, the opportunity came to do this. And I said to my wife, I was like, it's a bit quick and a bit dangerous. I'm not sure I should do it.
Yeah, and you're 5 months pregnant and blah,
yes,
blah, blah.
Yes, well, yeah. But equally, you just can't say no, can you? You just can't say no. So, yeah, and it looks like I'm going to go back again this year as well for my sins.
That's brilliant. I mean, such an absorbing talk, and we'll have more of that at the F1 season preview evening in March, March 6th or 9th? God.
8th. March 8th. I'm glad you're paying attention to this.
So professional. Sorry,
he's not hosting it.
We're not even
going to
retake that one. That's just awful. We've got Footman James on board in Classic and Sports Finance. And of course, a lot of our readers will look forward to seeing you there, where you'll regale us with more of your amazing stories and preview the season ahead. I just wish we had more time in this podcast because I guess we've got to plan a few more, but thank you, Karen, for joining us, and thank you, Simon and Rob.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Great. Fantastic.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.